I don't know about you, but I found Ecclesiastes to be a very unusual book because its message is so unexpected, so real, and so frank. And as we've discovered so far in our study in the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is the author. He wrote it late in life. He did not write it when he was a teenager or in his 20s or his 30s or his 40s. Ecclesiastes chapter 2 makes that really clear because he tells us when he writes this book, he tells us that he was married. In fact, in 1 Kings chapter 11, we find out that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. He had a lot of ladies in his life. We are also told in chapter 2 that he was extremely wealthy. He built anything and everything that he wanted. He held nothing back from himself that he wanted to build. The message is he completed many projects. Now, you don't do that in 2 days or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 1 year. He was late in life when he wrote this book. He lived a long time. He was unbelievably wise. That's the testimony of the Old Testament. And since he wrote Ecclesiastes late in life, it's obvious that he experienced a lot. And then he tells us, interestingly enough, that what we ought to do, his big recommendation for us, is to seek happiness, to seek pleasure. And he talked about sex, he talked about work, he talked about wisdom, he talked about being able to enjoy happiness in any way you can. And we know that that's exactly what he said because he told us that. We don't have to guess, that's what he told us. And in Ecclesiastes 2, he made the statement that momentary pleasure is the best. The only thing is it's not for sure, is what he tells us later on in the chapters that follow. And so you can count on temporary joy, but unfortunately, the message that he has been talking to us about in subsequent chapters is that we're like addicts. We keep needing a fix. And then he complained, starting in chapter 3, that God's in control of everything. So we're not in control. He wants to be in control. He wants to be able to control his life so he can enjoy his life. And he complains that there's a time for this, there's a time for that, there's a time for everything. He's really complaining is what he's doing. And his message is we can't control our life. Life's the pits is really his point. In the next chapter, he talks about the fact that life is oppressive and it's not fair. That's Ecclesiastes chapter 4. He tells us in chapter 5 that we got to be careful because if you make a promise to God, God expects you to pay it, and he's right. But he doesn't like the idea that you have to be careful around God. You got to be careful because there's God and there's you. In reality, he's right. He just doesn't like the fact that he has to be careful. And then he says that money is beneficial, but unfortunately, it can't guarantee happiness or pleasure either. And oh, by the way, and if you are happy, it's a gift from God. It's not guaranteed. That's the message of chapter 5, verse 19. And then in chapter 6, verse 1, he says, there's an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is prevalent. That is, there's a lot of it. And the evil that he's talking about is that there's exceptions to our ability to enjoy pleasure. And that's the theme of chapter 6. He just talks about one reason after another reason why we can't enjoy pleasure. Messages is not guaranteed. Pleasure is not guaranteed, and he gives us examples as to why it's not guaranteed. I think that's not too hard for us to figure out. I think you have all eaten something and ended up with a sour stomach. That happened to me just yesterday. I ate something, and I got nauseated in my stomach. I did not enjoy what I ate. You can go to a restaurant and get something bad, or be like somebody who went to McDonald's and bought something and ended up seeing a rat in their food. You didn't enjoy that either. So the message is that pleasure is not always guaranteed to us. There are lots of disappointments in life. When he got to the last verse of chapter 6, he says, for who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime? Now that's interesting given that he's been talking about what's really the best for us is to enjoy pleasure. And then he says, well, wait a minute, we really can't figure out what's best for us, and the reason you can't figure out what's really best for us is because pleasure is not guaranteed. That's been his point. And so he says, he will spend them like a shadow, for who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? So the message is, you're not sure what to do now in this life, and you sure don't know what's going to happen after you. The whole message of verse 12 is uncertainty in life. And so he's really depressed. So a very depressing kind of statement that he made in chapter 6 after making repeated statements that pleasure is the thing that we need to look at if you want to have some kind of joy in life. In fact, he's actually right. There are so many problems with life that joy is like a temporary sedative. It necessitizes you to the difficulties in life. It gives you a momentary high. What you eat, what you drink, and if you enjoy your labor, it helps you forget about the problems in life. In fact, at the end of chapter 5, he made the point that God keeps you so busy with enjoying life that you don't even think about the purpose of life. You don't think about where you're going. You don't think about what life's really about. And that's one of the benefits of pleasure. And so at the end of chapter 6, when he says, in reality, you can't even really figure out really what's best for you in your life, if we could add this, in order to achieve pleasure. I mean, you might think that something's going to bring you pleasure, and it really won't. So he's really saying that you can plan, you can do your best, but there's no guarantee. You can't even figure out what tomorrow is going to be like. I know people who made plans to do something and it got interrupted because they're now in a hospital. Or they're in a hospital. And so when we come to our study this morning, Solomon is going to give us some recommendations of things that at least he believes are good, because he's already said in verse 12, who knows what's good in a person's lifetime? So in chapter 7, he's now going to start telling us what's better and what's best. He's going to compare the wise man to the fool. And so he's trying to give us something that he knows is better. In other words, if you're going to plan for the future, if you're going to try to enjoy pleasure, at least here's some things that work, is his point. At least here's some things that he recommends for us in this very difficult life in which we live. So chapter 7, verse 1, he starts off, he says, a good name is better than a good ointment. So his first recommendation is we need to have a good reputation. He says, a good reputation is best. Now, you might wonder, how did I get there? Well, the Hebrew words for good ointment is good, and then the word for ointment in the Hebrew actually doesn't mean Ben-Gay for pain. It doesn't mean antifungal ointment. It's not referring to some kind of cream that you put on your body. It actually means oil in the Hebrew. It's a simple one word, O-I-L, oil. And this Hebrew word is used in Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verse 1, to refer to perfume. In Song of Solomon chapter 1, verse 3, it refers to a cologne of a man. And so I think that's the right way to understand it in this passage, is good perfume. In fact, I think the NIV actually calls it good perfume. And so the idea is that a good name is better than good perfume. The idea is that a good reputation is better than perfume or cologne. And it's a message we well understand. When he says a good reputation is best, I think we understand that you need a good reputation at work, or maybe in the community. At work, it gives you promotions. Usually it does, anyway. A good reputation at work usually results in a salary increase. Maybe you become a manager of the store. Who knows? Gives you opportunities. If you have a bad reputation, that usually results in nobody wants you. Nobody wants you at work. They don't give you promotion. You usually don't get a salary increase. They're waiting for you to leave. That's what they're doing. You even find the same principle at work in a church. Spiritual maturity opens doors. In the context of a church, spiritual maturity is a good reputation. on one occasion. I remember in California, I was in a meeting with a pastor, a group of us men together, and I remember one particular man, he started complaining that he wasn't a deacon. We had just gone through the process of selecting deacons, deaconesses, and elders, and I remember this gentleman, he just started coming unglued on the pastor because he wasn't asked to be a deacon of the church. And the pastor started trying to tell him what the criteria were, and the pastor was doing his best to calm this man down. And I just sat there and I said to myself, I think this man's proving right here on the spot why he shouldn't be a deacon. He has a heart problem. He doesn't understand that God didn't prepare him to be a leader in the church. Message is a good reputation is best. That's what Solomon says, and I think we all identify with that. A good name is better than something else that you might think is good. In other words, he says in verse 12, who knows what's good for a man during his lifetime? And Solomon says, a good name, a good reputation, that's what's best. And he's right. A good reputation goes a long way in life. At the last part of verse 1, he actually makes another recommendation. He says, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Now, all he's really saying is this, is your last day is better than your first day. The first day you were born wasn't as good. The last day is the best day of your life, is really what he's saying. I suspect that some of you are probably thinking to yourself, that's not true. I don't agree with that. You're probably thinking that the last day is the worst day of my life. Well, stop to think for a second. So far, what he's told us is that the best thing for us to do is reach for a bottle of pleasure or to reach for a plate of fun or to enjoy our work. He's put it this way. He says, what's best is eat, drink, and tell yourself that your labor is good. That was the end of chapter 2. He said the same thing at the end of chapter 5. So that's been a repeat. So the message he's been sending us is what's really important in life is to pursue pleasure, right? The only problem that he's been talking about now since chapter 5, especially in 6, is that pleasure is not guaranteed. Pleasure is not guaranteed. Yeah, it's really great, but it's not guaranteed. You can't bank on it. In fact, life could be full of a lot of unhappiness. He's given us a lot of reasons why pleasure isn't guaranteed. And the message he gave us at the end of chapter 5 and through 6 is that if you do enjoy pleasure, it is a gift from God, but it's not guaranteed. And I think most of us understand that. And so he says, you know what's really best? Just to be dead. Then you don't have to worry about the unhappy parts of life, about the miserable parts of life. As I was thinking about that, I thought, you know, Solomon, you've got to be wrong. For the unbeliever, for the non-Christian, this is the best time of their life. For the non-Christian, this is heaven. For the non-Christian, when they die, they're going to hell. The best day is not the last day of your life. But it's true for a Christian. For a Christian, I get out of this miserable, sinful world, and I get to go to heaven. In Romans 3:23, we're told that we've all sinned, right? Romans 6:23 says the wages of sin is what? Death. In Romans chapter 7, Paul struggles. He says, I don't do the things I want to do. The things that I don't want to do, I do. And then in verse 24, he says, oh, wretched man that I am, who will release me from this wretched body of mine? He's looking to go to heaven. In fact, he says in Philippians, for me to live is Christ and to die is what? Gain. So when Solomon says that the day of one's death is better, you know what he's doing? What he's doing is he's preparing us for chapter 12. He's wanting us to think about death. That's what he wants you to think about. And I have had people tell me that they don't want to go to a funeral parlor. They don't want to go to a mortuary. Have you ever been to a mortuary? it can be a little bit difficult, can it? That's the next verse. Verse 2 is the next recommendation. It's his third recommendation. And he says, visiting a mortuary is better than going to a restaurant. That's my translation. And the reason he says that is because that's the end of your life. In verse 2, he says, it is better to go to a house of mourning. The actual Hebrew means mortuary or funeral. So it's better to go to a funeral, to a house of a funeral, where they bury people, than to go to a house of feasting. That is where there's food. Try a restaurant. So I've just said that it's better to go to a mortuary than to go to your best restaurant, because that's the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. I thought that was interesting. He says the living takes it to heart. When you start to think about death, you start to take it to heart. I had a lady one time tell me that she doesn't like to go to funerals. She explained it was too depressing. And she said so she avoids them, because she doesn't want to be unhappy. So she never bothered to go to funerals of her children, didn't go to the funerals of her parents, doesn't go to funerals of anybody else, because it's just too depressing. She wants to have fun. And I know that there are people who don't like to go to funerals because it's depressing. I have to admit that when I have done funerals, I've done a lot of them over the years, it's always a sobering time. I have yet to find somebody laughing at a funeral. I guess it probably happens someplace, but I've never yet seen anybody laugh at a funeral. Maybe it happened, I just don't remember. It's possible, I guess. But Solomon says it's better to go to a funeral than to go to a house of feasting, to a restaurant. Now, most of us would pick the restaurant, I think, over the funeral, over the mortuary. Solomon says, that's not wise, as you're going to see. He's going to tell us that's not wise. He's going to tell us the fool picks the restaurant over the mortuary. And you might say, like, why? Well, you're going to see. So verse 3 fits the woman I was just talking about. Sorrow is better than laughter, Solomon says. For when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. He's saying that if you experience some sadness and you get realistic about life, and you put life in its proper context, then you might be happy more often than you would be otherwise. Because when the trials of life come along, you're always wanting it to be what? Happy. So you don't like it. A lady recently, she wrote an article. She put it on the web. She sent me an email, and she's talking about contentment. The problem that Solomon is talking about here is somebody who isn't willing to live with the state in life that God has given them. And they're not willing to think about the future. Verse 4. In verse 4, he says, the mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, and the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. Now, the house of pleasure is our restaurant. The house of mourning is the mortuary. He's continuing the theme of verse 2. So verse 2, 3, and 4 all go together. It's one continuous thought. Here in verse 4, he tells, the mind of the wise is in the mortuary. He's thinking about life. He's thinking about the purpose of life. He's thinking about where he's going. Thinking about death. The mind of the fool doesn't want to think about those things. They just want to have fun. Fun, 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 fun. And that's what the fool wants. The fool is not willing to be serious about life. And when he says the mind is in, he's talking about the fact that you're thinking about it, you're dwelling on it, it's not something you're trying to escape. Tony Evans wrote a very interesting article about death. I thought I'd just read it to you. I think it helps illustrate what he's talking about here. Tony Evans writes this. He says, death today can look fairly nice. The folks down at the funeral home, mortuary, know how to get us looking fairly good when we are dead. The funeral parlors have professional makeup artists who dress you up and make you look good. I've seen some people look better dead than they ever looked alive, but they're still dead. I'll add this. I've never seen anybody yet who I thought looked better dead than they were alive. I've always thought the live person looked better, but anyway. Dead people used to be put into crude wooden boxes and carried around in horse-drawn carriages. You don't die like that today. Nowadays, when you die in style. We're talking bronze caskets lined with linen. If you die before you had a chance to put your head on a satin pillow, no worries. Now's your chance. Always wanted to ride in a limousine? You got it. A fleet, in fact. You will stop traffic that day. People will pull over just because you were riding by, but you're still dead. Back in the day, the coffin would be lowered into the ground by ropes and tied around the top and the bottom of the casket, and then the ropes would just be dropped. Today, there are no ropes. A nickel-plated machine eases you down to the bottom. You don't wake up, so you get put 6 feet under in the most comfortable way possible, but you're still dead. And whether it's a coffin or a casket, a limousine or a horse-drawn carriage, a nickel-plated machine or a rope, you're still dead. A fancy death doesn't change that reality. And what Solomon is saying is that we need to be real. We need to think about reality. Why are you here? What is life all about? It's not about fun and pleasure. It's not guaranteed. If you enjoy pleasure, it's a gift. It's not promised. And chapter 6 was his examples of when it doesn't happen. Unfortunately, pleasure masks reality. I'm just amazed, actually, that Solomon recommends pleasure to us. I think the reason he does is that he's making the point that that's about the only thing that helps you get through life. Is the momentary things that we have that we call pleasure. But pleasure has serious pitfalls. The major one, you can't control it. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 17 are very interesting for us. It actually describes the fact that our world system pulls at us to seek pleasure. In fact, the world system is all about pleasure. Remember the passage? It says, "Do not love the world nor the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." Now, most of us, we read that and we say, "I don't want to love the world," because it's obvious that it's saying, "Do not love the world." Verse 16 is a really interesting verse. It says, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh," try emotion, "and the lust of the eyes," try emotion, "and the pride of life," that's actually emotion, "is not from the Father, but from the world." What the Apostle John, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit here, is actually describing is that we're driven by our passions. It's what we want. Or put it another way, I get pleasure from eating things, try lust of the flesh. I get pleasure from drinking things, try lust of the flesh. I get pleasure from the lust of the eyes, and he's been talking about the eyes seeing things and being satisfied. How about the boastful pride of life, try enjoying your labor, feeling good about what you've done. Oh, I really succeeded. I'm very successful. That's what the world system offers us. And Solomon says, wait a minute. It's better to go to a house of mourning, better to go to a mortuary, better to go to a place where there's a funeral and think about the end of life, not how to enjoy yourself. He's being serious because he says sorrow is better than laughter. He says, come on, get serious. Quit seeking the fun stuff. Verse 5. When you come to verse 5 now, this is the fourth recommendation. He says, it is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. I think it's pretty clear, isn't it? He says it's better to want open rebuke than to listen to a beautiful song sung by some fool. So the idea that the fool is singing, and whatever they're singing, we don't know. He doesn't describe it. He's just talking about the fact that a fool is doing the singing. In my life, probably in my 30s, I made a commitment that when somebody criticizes me or rebukes me, I'm going to dwell on it, think about it, take it to heart, because maybe they're right. Because I found in my own life that my tendency when somebody rebuked me or said something that I thought was insulting or not complimentary, I wanted to defend myself. That was characteristic of me in my teen years and 20s. And so when I got to my 30s, I said to myself, I want to be a wise man. What does a wise man do? A wise man accepts rebuke. Most of us can't accept open rebuke. I found over the years, and especially in the ministry, that I have to be very careful when I rebuke somebody or I try to motivate somebody in a direction. I'm very careful, very nice, have to, because open rebuke usually causes trouble. Most people can't accept open rebuke. And you know why I think that's true? Because we want pleasure. We want life to be enjoyable. We don't want to be hurt. What I've also found is that usually when somebody feels hurt, they usually then turn on me and tell me I was unloving. I had a friend who was an elder. He was a very wise man. In fact, he was a man that almost every man on the board looked up to. He made a comment to me one day. He said, we never do it right, talking about rebuke. He says, there's always something that goes wrong. And I thought, that was an interesting comment. Always something goes wrong. You know why always something goes wrong? It's because that depends on people. And it's really hard to motivate somebody because nobody wants to be unhappy. And so I think it's impossible to do it right unless the person is committed to being a wise person and is willing to be open to rebuke. It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than to listen to the song of a fool. What's the message about the fool? He just wants to enjoy life. They don't want to hear any rebuke. Verse 6, for as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. Verse 6 continues the message. And what he's talking about when he says the crackling of a thorn bush under a pot, one of the commentators made the comment that the fool likes to laugh and show off. So it's singing, it's having fun, it's being loud, it's being silly, it's being stupid, it's showing off. It's just having fun. The fool enjoys being a fool. So Solomon says it's better to be open to rebuke. That's the message. It's better. There are a number of proverbs that hit this theme. Proverbs chapter 9, verse 8, for example, says, do not rebuke a mocker or he will hate you. Rebuke a wise man and he will what? Love you. How about Proverbs 13:13 says, the one who has contempt for instruction will pay the penalty, but the one who respects a command will be rewarded. So again, the same idea. So what Solomon is saying here in this chapter are true. He's giving us biblical principles, okay? Verse 7. Verse 7 is the next recommendation. He says, for oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Now, this one might be a little bit of a challenge for a second, but what he's saying is simply this, is that a wise man hates oppression. When he says, makes a wise man mad, the word for makes in the Hebrew is imperfect. It implies that the wise man, he has a pattern of hating oppression. In other words, when something bad happens, the wise man hates it. And he hates it, and he hates it. It's a characteristic of a wise person. Then he makes this incredible statement. He says, and a bribe corrupts the heart. He's talking about the fool. He's been talking about the wise man versus the fool. And so we're to understand the last part of this is the fool, they're willing to take a bribe if it gives them fun. Or put another way, they're willing to be oppressive if it gives them fun. Because his theme through this is about pleasure. Verse 8 now is the next recommendation. In this verse, he says, the end of a matter is better than its beginning, and patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit or try pride. And so he's saying it is better to be patient. The fool is too proud to wait. I don't know if you've experienced it. I've experienced it. And that is that I start a project and I'd like to see my project ended right away. Have you ever started something and you wish it was done tomorrow? Have you ever done that? Some of you are nodding your head and some of you aren't. Maybe those of you who aren't, you don't mind if it never gets done. I don't know. But the idea here is that you start a project and he said, when it gets done, it's better than when you started. When you started, it was an idea, and when it's done, it's done. You have it. I know that when I've started a project, I have work to do. It's nice when the work comes to an end. Also, when I start a project, I make mistakes, and I have to correct the mistakes. You know, the finished product's better than all of the problem parts of the task of putting it together. In order to get accomplished, what's required? He says patience. He says the end of a matter is better than its beginning. And then he says, patience of spirit is better than haughtiness, try pride of spirit. In other words, the proud person, not willing to be patient, you just want it done. That's all you care about. So verse 8, the recommendation to be patient. Verse 9 is, do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. So he's continuing this comparison of wise versus fools. It's a very interesting passage of Scripture. I'd never captured how much he deals with the wise versus the fool until I got into this study here of chapter 7. But he's talking about the wise person versus the fool all through this. And the characteristic of the wise person is that he's serious, and the characteristic of the fool is that he wants fun. Verse 9, do not be eager in your heart to be angry. The idea is that the wise person, they're not eager. Again, it's the imperfect. That is that they're not always eager to be angry. In contrast, the fool is always angry. Fool's always getting upset about something. It doesn't mean he's angry every day, but in comparison to others, he's frequently angry. I mean, anger is a characteristic of a fool. Maybe they can't get their work done. Maybe they're not enjoying the fun. And so they get angry because they're not enjoying their fun that they're really after. What he's really been saying throughout this chapter is that the fool is addicted to fun. The fool has to have fun. Verse 10. Verse 10 is his next recommendation, the 8th one. We've got one more to go. He says, do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it's not with wisdom that you ask about this. Again, it's the idea of what's wise and what's foolish. The foolish person, we're to understand, is the person who says, oh, you know, the good old days. And Solomon says, they weren't the good old days. He says, it's not from wisdom that you ask about the old days. The message is, it's not as good as you thought. Just recently, I was telling my wife that I would like to go back. I was being a fool for a few minutes. And I would like to go back to a particular situation in California before we came here to Tucson. And I told her, I just like to relive those good old days. I momentarily forgot Solomon's advice. And my wife said, yes, but do you remember? Do you remember? Do you remember? And she started going through all the negatives. And all of a sudden, I realized that wasn't a good idea. She reminded me that the good old days weren't the good old days. I had glossed them. I had glossed the good old days. The good old days were the bad old days. Verse 11. Verse 11 and 12 is the 9th recommendation. And this one, we can take this one to heart. He says it's better to pursue wisdom. Wisdom along with an inheritance is good, and an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection just as money is protection. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. We agree with these two verses because he's telling us this. It's better to pursue wisdom. That's a message of Scripture, Old Testament, New Testament. And then he says wisdom plus money is an advantage. We talked about that before. Remember when we were in chapter 2? We made the point that research has shown that if somebody gets an inheritance, they usually squander it within a year. Within 2 years, I think the number was like 95% of the money's gone. So if you have a big inheritance, you're going to go give it to somebody, give it to your children. More than likely, they're going to squander it the first year. If they didn't do a good job on the first year, by the end of the second year, it's probably all gone. So if you give them a whole bunch of money to last them the rest of their life, in fact, we gave statistics of people who actually give away millions and millions and millions of dollars, and by the third year, they're usually paupers. They blow it. So wisdom plus money is an advantage, is right. Wisdom plus knowledge is protection. But what's he telling us? The fool has no advantage or protection because he has no wisdom. The fool's not wise. They just blow the money and they don't really care about knowledge. They just care about fun. Life's all about what they can enjoy. Verse 13. Verse 13 and 14 is Solomon's conclusions. He says, it's impossible for us to change what God has planned and does. That's his summary. So let me read it. Consider the work of God. For who is able to straighten what he has bent? Now that at first might strike you as a difficult statement, but he's just saying this. God already has a plan. And you don't know whether it's straight or bent from your perspective. In other words, you don't know how it's going to impact you. From your perspective, it might appear to be bent. And he's saying, you don't know what to do with that. Consider the work of God, for who is able to straighten what he has bent? And if you think it's bent, you can't change it. So if you are pursuing something that will give you pleasure, you can't change it. If your conclusion is it's not going to be what you want, you cannot change it. So once again, he's making the point that if you are able to enjoy pleasure, it's a gift, but it's not guaranteed. Verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider he made one as well as the other, so that man will not discover anything that will be after him. So right there, he makes the point that sometimes you might enjoy life, other times you might not. Not guaranteed. It's in the hand of God. Sounds like Job. Remember Job? After he went through all of his trials? Remember his wife told him to curse and die? What did Job tell her? He said, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" So Solomon says, we need to learn to be content. You can't always have fun. You can't always have pleasure. You got to be realistic. Think about the funeral. Think about why you're here. You're not here just for fun. What's he doing? He's setting us up for chapter 12, where he's going to tell us to fear God and obey his commandments. That's what he's doing. The reality is we need a God focus. We need to get off of ourselves. We need to stop wanting fun. We're not here to have fun. We're here to give glory to God. We're here to please our God. That's why we're here. We're not here for ourselves. I've summarized our response this way. Be a wise person and follow Solomon's advice. He's given us some good advice here in chapter 7. Biblical advice. And thank God when you experience pleasure, but don't pursue it. Don't make it an addiction. Note, pleasure is not guaranteed. And your purpose in life is to live for Christ. First Philippians chapter 1, verse 21 to 22. And I would also add Philippians chapter 4, where we're told that we are to be content. Paul says, "I've learned to be content in whatever state I am in." Why? Because it's not about us. Our life should be about who? Christ. Let's pray.